Wolf Hall, Disc 5.
The Cardinal had sat long over the letter listing her virtues, writing it in his own hand. Womanly modesty? Chastity? Can I say chastity? You'd better. The Cardinal looked up.
Know something?
He hesitated and returned to his letter.
Apt to bear children? Well, her family is fertile. Loving and faithful daughter of the church? Perhaps stretching a point. They say she has the scriptures in French set up in her chamber and lets her women read them, but I would have no positive knowledge of that.
King Francois allows the Bible in French. She learned her scriptures there, I suppose.
Ah, but women, you see, women reading the Bible, there's another point of contention. Does she know what Brother Martin thinks is a woman's place? We shouldn't mourn, he says, if our wife or daughter dies in childbirth. She's only doing what God made her for. Very harsh, Brother Martin, very intractable. And perhaps she's not a Bible woman. Perhaps it is a slur on her. Perhaps it is just that she's out of patience with churchmen. I wish she did not blame me for her difficulties. Not blame me so very much.
Lady Anne sends friendly messages to the Cardinal, but he thinks she does not mean them.
If, Wolsey had said, I saw the prospect of an annulment for the King, I would go to the Vatican in person, have my veins opened, and allow the documents to be written in my own blood. Do you think, if Anne knew that, it would content her?
No, I don't think so. But if you see any of the Boleyns, make them the offer.
By the way, I suppose you know a person called Humphrey Monmouth. He is the man who had Tyndale in his house for 6 months before he ran off to wherever. They say he sends him money still, but that can't possibly be true, as how would he know where to send? Monmouth, I am merely mentioning his name, because... Now, why am I?
The Cardinal had closed his eyes.
Because I am merely mentioning it.
The Bishop of London has already filled his own prisons. He's locking up Lutherans and sectaries in Newgate and the Fleet with common criminals. There they remain until they recant and do public penance. If they relapse, they will be burned. There are no second chances. When Monmouth's house is raided, it is clear of all suspect writings. It's almost as if he was forewarned. There are neither books nor letters that link him to Tyndale and his friends. All the same, he's taken to the Tower. His family is terrified. Monmouth is a gentle and fatherly man, a master draper, well-liked in his guild, and the city at large. He loves the poor, and buys cloth even when trade is bad, so the weavers may keep in work. No doubt the imprisonment is designed to break him. His business is tottering by the time he is released. They have to let him go, for lack of evidence, because you can't make anything of a heap of ashes in the hearth. Monmouth himself would be a heap of ashes if Thomas More had his way.
"Not come to see us yet, Master Cromwell," he says. "Still breaking dry bread in cellars? Come now, my tongue is sharper than you deserve. We must be friends, you know."
It sounds like a threat. Moore moves away, shaking his head.
"We must be friends."
Ashes, dry bread. England was always, the Cardinal says, a miserable country, home to an outcast and abandoned people, who are working slowly towards their deliverance, and who are visited by God with special tribulations. If England lies under God's curse or some evil spell, it has seemed for a time that the spell has been broken by the Golden King and his Golden Cardinal. But those golden years are over, and this winter the sea will freeze. The people who see it will remember it all their lives. Joanne has moved into the house at Austin Friars with her husband John Williamson, and her daughter, little Joanne, Jo, the children call her, seeing she is too small for a full name. John Williamson is needed in the Cromwell business. Thomas, says Joanne, what exactly is your business these days? In this way she detains him in talk. Our business, he says, is making people rich. There are many ways to do this, and John is going to help me out with them. But John won't have to deal with my Lord Cardinal, will he? The gossip is that people of influence, have complained to the king, and the king has complained to Wolsey about the monastic houses he has closed down. They don't think of the good use to which the cardinal has put the assets. They don't think of the colleges, the scholars he maintains, the libraries he's founding. They're only interested in getting their own fingers in the spoils. And because they've been cut out of the business, they pretend to believe the monks have been left naked and lamenting in the road. They haven't. They've been transferred elsewhere, to bigger houses, better run. Some of the younger ones have been let go, boys who have no calling to the life. Questioning them, he usually finds they know nothing, which makes nonsense of the Abbey's claims to be the light of learning. They can stumble through a Latin prayer, but when you say, "Go on then, tell me what it means," they say, "Means, master," as if they thought that words and their meanings were so loosely attached that the tether would snap at the first tug. "Don't worry about what people say," he tells Joanne. "I take responsibility for it. I do, alone." The cardinal has received the complaints with a supreme hauteur. He has grimly noted in his file the names of the complainers. Then he has taken out of his file the list and handed it over to his man with a tight smile. All he cares for are his new buildings, his banners flying, his coat of arms embossed on the brickwork, his Oxford scholars. He's plundering Cambridge to get the brightest young doctors over to Cardinal College. There was trouble before Easter, when the dean found six of the new men in possession of a number of forbidden books. "Lock them up by all means," Wolsey said. "Lock them up and reason with them. If the weather is not too hot or not too wet, I might come up and reason with them myself." No use trying to explain this to Joanne. She only wants to know her husband's not within arrow shot of the slanders that are flying. "You know what you are doing, I suppose." Her eyes dart upwards. "At least, Tom, you always look as if you do." Her voice, her footstep, her raised eyebrow, her pointed smile, everything reminds him of Liz. Sometimes he turns, thinking that Liz has come into the room. The new arrangements confuse Grace. She knows her mother's first husband was called Tom Williams. They name him in their household prayers. "Is Uncle Williamson therefore his son?" she asks. Joanne tries to explain it. "Save your breath," Anne says. She taps her head. Her bright little fingers bounce from the seed pearls of her cap. "Slow," she says. Later, he says to her, "Grace isn't slow, just young." "I never remember I was as foolish as that." "They're all slow except us. Is that right?" Anne's face says more or less that is right. "Why do people marry?"
"So there can be children."
"Horses don't marry, but there are foals."
"Most people," he says, "feel it increases their happiness."
"Oh yes, that," Anne says. "May I choose my husband?"
"Of course," he says, meaning up to a point.
"Then I choose Rafe." For a minute, for 2 minutes together, he feels his life might mend. Then he thinks, how could I ask Rafe to wait? He needs to set up his own household. Even 5 years from now, Anne would be a very young bride. "I know," she says, "and time goes by so slowly."
"It's true. One always seems to be waiting for something." "You seem to have thought it through," he says. "You don't have to spell out to her. Keep this to yourself, because she knows to do that. You don't have to lead this female child through a conversation with the little shifts and demurs that most women demand. She's not like a flower, a nightingale. She's like...
like a merchant adventurer, he thinks. A look in the eye to skewer your intentions, and a deal done with a slap of the palm. She pulls off her cap. She twists the seed pearls in her fingers and tugs at a strand of her dark hair, stretching it and pulling out its wave. She scoops up the rest of her hair, twists it, and wraps it around her neck. I could do that twice, she says, if my neck were smaller. She sounds fretful. Grace thinks I cannot marry Rafe because we are related. She thinks everybody who lives in a house must be cousins. You are not Rafe's cousin. Are you sure? I am sure. And put your cap back on. What will your aunt say? She makes a face. It is a face imitative of her aunt Joanne. Oh, Thomas, she murmurs. You are always so sure. He raises a hand to cover his smile. For a moment, Joanne seems less worrying. Put your cap on, he says mildly. She squashes it back on her head. She's so little, he thinks. But still, she'd be better suited by a helmet. How did Rafe come here? She says. He came here from Essex, because that's where his father happened to be at the time. His father, Henry, was a steward to Sir Edward Belknap, who was a cousin of the Grey family, and so related to the Marquis of Dorset, and the Marquis was Wolsey's patron when the Cardinal was a scholar at Oxford. So, yes, cousins come into it. And the fact that, when he'd only been back in England for a year or two, he was already somehow in the Cardinal's affinity, though he'd never set eyes on the great man himself. Already he, Cromwell, was a man useful to employ. He worked for the Dorset family on various of their tangled lawsuits. The old Marchioness had him tracking down bed hangings and carpets for her. Send that, be here. To her, all the world was a menial. If she wanted a lobster or a sturgeon, she ordered it up. And if she wanted good taste, she ordered it in the same way. The Marchioness would run her hand over Florentine silks, making little squeaks of pleasure. You bought it, Master Cromwell, she would say, and very beautiful it is. Your next task is to work out how we pay for it. Somewhere in this maze of obligations and duties, he met Henry Sadler and agreed to take his son into his household. Teach him all you know, Henry proposed, a little fearfully. He arranged to collect Rafe on his way back from business in his part of the country, but he picked a bad day for it. Mud and drenching rain, clouds chasing in from the coast. It was not much after two when he splashed up to the door, but the light was already failing. Henry Sadler said, Can't you stay? You won't make it back to London before they close the gates. I ought to try to get home tonight, he said. I have to be in court. And then there'll be my Lady Dorset's debt collector to see off, and you know how that is. Mistress Sadler glanced fearfully outside and down at her child, for whom she must now part, trusting him, at the age of seven, to the weather and the roads. This is not harsh, this is usual. But Rafe was so small that he almost thought it harsh. His baby curls had been cropped, and his ginger hair stood up at the crown. His mother and father knelt down and patted him. Then they swaddled and pulled and knotted him into multiple layers of overwrapped padding, so that his slight frame swelled into the likeness of a small barrel. He looked down at the child and out at the rain and thought, Sometimes I should be warm and dry like other men. How do they contrive it while I never can? Mistress Sadler knelt and took her son's face in her hands. Remember everything we have told you, she whispered. Say your prayers. Master Cromwell, please see he says his prayers. When she looked up, he saw that her eyes were blurred with tears, and he saw that the child could not bear it, and was shaking inside his vast wrappings and about to howl. He threw his cloak around himself. A scatter of raindrops flew from it, baptized the scene. Well, Rafe, what do you think? If you're man enough? He held out his gauntleted hand. The child's hand slotted into it. Shall we see how far we get? We'll do this fast so you don't look back, he thought. The wind and rain drove the parents back from the open door. He threw Rafe into the saddle. The rain came at them horizontally. On the outskirts of London, the wind dropped. He lived at Fenchurch Street then, At the door, a servant held out his arms in an offer to take Rafe, but he said, "We drowned men will stick together." The child had become a dead weight in his arms, shrinking flesh inside seven sodden layers of interwrapped wool. He stood Rafe before the fire. Vapours rose from him. Roused by the warmth, he put up small frozen fingers and tentatively began to unpick, to unravel himself. "What place is this?" he said, in a distinct, polite tone. "London," he said. "Fenchurch Street. Home." He took a linen towel and gently blotted from his face the journey just past. He rubbed his head. Rafe's hair stood up in spikes. Liz came in. "Heaven direct me, boy or hedgehog?" Rafe turned his face to her. He smiled. He slept on his feet. When the sweat comes back this summer, 1528, people say, as they did last year, that he won't get it if you don't think about it. But how can you not? He sends the girls out of London, first to the Stepney House and then beyond. This time the court is infected. Henry tries to outride the plague, moving from one hunting lodge to the next. Anne is sent to Hever. The fever breaks out there amongst the Boleyn family, and the lady's father goes down first. He lives. Her sister Mary's husband dies. Anne falls ill, but within 24 hours she's reported back on her feet. Still, it can wreck a woman's looks. "You don't know what outcome to pray for," he says to the cardinal. The cardinal says, "I am praying for Queen Catherine, and also for the dear Lady Anne. I am praying for King Francois's armies in Italy, that they may meet with success, and yet not so much success that they forget how they need their friend and ally King Henry. I am praying for the King's Majesty and all his councillors, and for the beasts in the field, and for the Holy Father and the Curia. May their decisions be guided from above. I am praying for Martin Luther, and for all those infected with this heresy, and for all who combat him, most especially the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, our dear friend Thomas More. Against all common sense and observation, I am praying for a good harvest and for the rain to stop. I am praying for everybody. I am praying for everything. That is what it is to be a cardinal. Only when I say to the Lord, 'Now about Thomas Cromwell,' does God say to me, 'Wolsey, what have I told you? Don't you know when to give up?'" When the infection reaches Hampton Court, the cardinal seals himself off from the world. Only four servants are allowed to approach him. When he re-emerges, he does look as if he's been praying. At the end of the summer, when the girls come back to London, they have grown, and Grace's hair has been bleached by the sun. She is shy of him, and he wonders if now she can only associate him with that night when he carried her to bed, after she had been told her mother was dead. Anne says, "Next summer, whatever happens, I prefer to stay with you." The sickness has left the city, but the cardinal's prayers have met with variable success. The harvest is poor. The French are losing badly in Italy, and their commander has died of plague. Autumn comes. Gregory goes back to his tutor. His reluctance is clear enough, though little about Gregory is clear to him. "What is it?" he asks him. "What's wrong?" The boy won't say. With other people he is sunny and lively, but with his father, guarded and polite, as if to keep a formal distance between them. He says to Joanne, "Is Gregory frightened of me?" Quick as a needle into canvas, she darts at him. "He's not a monk. Has he cause?" Then she softens. "Thomas, why should he be? You're a kind father. In fact, I think too much so." "If he doesn't want to go back to his tutor, I could send him to Antwerp, to my friend Stephen Vaughan. Gregory will never make a man of business." "No. You can't see him beating out a deal on interest rates with one of the Fugger's agents or some sniggering de Medici clerk. So what will I do with him?" "I'll tell you what to do. When he is ready, marry him well. Gregory is a gentleman. Anyone can see that." Anne is eager to make a start with Greek. He's thinking who best to teach her, asking around. He wants someone congenial, whom he can talk to over supper, a young scholar who will live in the house. He regrets the choice of tutor he's made for his son and nephews, but he won't take them away at this point. The man is quarrelsome, and to be sure, there was a sad episode when one of the boys set fire to his room because he'd been reading in bed with a candle. "It wouldn't be Gregory, would it?" he had said, always hopeful. The master seemed to think he was treating it as a joke. "And he's always sending him bills that he believes he's paid. I need a household accountant," he thinks. He sits at his desk, piled high with drawings and plans from Ipswich and Cardinal College, with craftsmen's estimates and bills for Woolsey's planting schemes. He examines a scar in the palm of his hand. It is an old burn mark, and it looks like a twist of rope. He thinks about Putney. He thinks about Walter. He thinks about the jittery sidestep of a skittish horse, the smell of the brewery. He thinks about the kitchen at Lambeth, and about the tow-headed boy who used to bring the eels. He remembers taking the eel boy by the hair and dipping his head in a tub of water and holding it under. He thinks, "Did I really do that? I wonder why." The cardinal's probably right. I am beyond redemption. The scar sometimes itches. It is as hard as a spur of bone. He thinks, "I need an accountant. I need a Greek tutor. I need Joanne. But who says I can have what I need?" He opens a letter. It is from a priest called Thomas Bird. He is in want of money, and it seems the cardinal owes him some. He makes a note to have it checked out and paid, then picks up the letter again. It mentions two men, two scholars, Clark and Sumner. He knows the names. They're two of the six college men, the Oxford men who had the Lutheran books. "Lock them up and reason with them," the cardinal had said. He holds the letter and glances away from it. He knows something bad is coming. Its shadow moves on the wall. He reads. Clark and Sumner are dead. The cardinal should be told, the writer says. Having no other secure place, the dean saw fit to shut them in the college cellars, the deep cold cellars intended for storing fish. Even in that silent place, secret, icy, the summer plague sought them out. They died in the dark and without a priest. All summer we have prayed, and not prayed hard enough. Had the cardinal simply forgotten his heretics? I must go and tell him, he thinks. It is the first week in September. His suppressed grief becomes anger. But what can he do with anger? It also must be suppressed. But when at last the year turns and the cardinal says, "Thomas, what shall I give you for a New Year gift?" he says, "Give me a little bilney." And without waiting for the cardinal to answer, he says, "My lord, he's been in the tower for a year. The tower would frighten anyone, but Bilney is a timid man and not strong, and I am afraid he's straitly kept. And, my lord, you remember Sumner and Clark and how they died? My lord, use your power, write letters, petition the king if you must. Let him go." The cardinal leans back. He puts his fingertips together. "Thomas," he says, "my dear Thomas Cromwell." "Very well. But Father Bilney must go back to Cambridge. He must give up his project of going to Rome and addressing the Pope to bring him to a right way of thinking. There are very deep vaults under the Vatican, and my arm will not be able to reach him there." It is at the tip of his tongue to say, "You could not reach into the cellars of your own college," but he stops himself. Heresy, his brush with it, is a little indulgence that the cardinal allows him. He's always glad to have the latest bad books filleted, and any gossip from the steelyard where the German merchants live. He's happy to turn over a text or two, to enjoy an after-supper debate. But for the cardinal, any contentious point must be wrapped around and around again with a fine filament of words, fine as split hairs. Any dangerous opinion must be so plumped out with laughing apologies that it is as fat and harmless as the cushions you lean on. It is true that when he was told of the deaths underground, my lord was moved to tears.
"How could I not have known," he said, "those fine young men?"
He cries easily in recent months, though that does not mean his tears are less genuine. And indeed now he wipes away a tear because he knows the story. Little Bilney at Gray's Inn, the man who spoke Polish, the futile messengers, the dazed children, Elizabeth Cromwell's face set in the fixed severity of death. He leans across his desk and says,
"Thomas, please don't despair. You still have your children, and in time you may wish to marry again."
"I am a child," he thinks, "who cannot be consoled." The cardinal places his hand over his. The strange stones flicker in the light, showing their depths. A garnet like a blood bubble. A turquoise with a silver sheen. A diamond with a yellow-grey blink like the eye of a cat. He will never tell the cardinal about Mary Boleyn, though the impulse will arise. Wolsey might laugh. He might be scandalized. He has to smuggle him the content without the context. Autumn 1528. He is at court on the cardinal's business. Mary is running towards him, her skirts lifted, showing a fine pair of green silk stockings. Is her sister Anne chasing her? He waits to see. She stops abruptly.
"Ah, it's you."
He wouldn't have thought Mary knew him. She puts one hand against the panelling, catching her breath, and the other against his shoulder, as if he were just part of the wall. Mary is still dazzlingly pretty, fair, soft-featured.
"My uncle this morning," she says, "my uncle Norfolk, he was roaring against you. I said to my sister, 'Who is this terrible man?' And she said,
'He's the one who looks like a wall.'"
Mary takes her hand away. She laughs, blushes, and with a little heave of her bosom, tries to get her breath back.
"What was my Lord of Norfolk's complaint?"
"Oh," she flaps a hand to fan herself, "he said, cardinals, legates, it was never merry in England when we had cardinals among us. He says the Cardinal of York is despoiling the noble houses. He says he will have all to rule himself, and the lords to be like schoolboys creeping in for a whipping. Not that you should take any note of what I say."
She looks fragile, breathless still, but his eyes tell her to talk. She gives a little laugh and says,
"My brother George roared too. He said that the Cardinal of York was born in a hospital for paupers, and he employs a man was born in the gutter. My Lord Father said, 'Come now, my dear boy, you lose nothing if you are exact. Not quite a gutter, but a brewer's yard, I believe, for he's certainly no gentleman.'"
Mary takes a step back. "You look a gentleman. I like your grey velvet. Where did you find that?"
"Italy."
He has been promoted from being the wall. Mary's hand creeps back. Absorbed, she strokes him.
"Could you get me some? They're a bit sober for a woman, perhaps."
Not for a widow, he thinks. The thought must show on his face, because Mary says,
"That's it, you see. William Carey's dead."
He bows his head and is very correct. Mary alarms him.
"The court misses him sadly, as you must yourself."
A sigh. "He was kind, given the circumstances."
"It must have been difficult for you."
"When the king turned his mind to Anne, he thought that, knowing how things are done in France, she might accept a certain position in the court. And in his heart, as he put it, he said he would give up all other mistresses. The letters he has written in his own hand."
"Really?"
The cardinal always says that you can never get the king to write a letter himself, even to another king, even to the Pope, even when it might make a difference.
"Yes. Since last summer, he writes, and then sometimes where he would sign Henricus Rex."
She takes his hand, turns up his palm, and with her forefinger traces a shape.
"Where he should sign his name, instead he draws a heart, and he puts their initials in it."
"Oh, you mustn't laugh." She can't keep the smile off her face.
"He says he is suffering."
He wants to say, Mary, these letters, can you steal them for me? My sister says this is not France, and I am not a fool like you, Mary. She knows I was Henry's mistress, and she sees how I am left, and she takes a lesson from it. He's almost holding his breath, but she's reckless now. She will have her say. I tell you, they will ride over hell to marry. They have vowed it. Anne says she will have him, and she cares not if Catherine and every Spaniard is in the sea and drowned. What Henry wants, he will have, and what Anne wants, she will have. And I can say that because I know them both. Who better? Her eyes are soft and welling with tears. So that is why, she says, why I miss William Carey, because now she is everything, and I am to be swept out after supper like the old rushers. Now I'm no one's wife. They can say anything they like to me. My father says I'm a mouth to feed, and my uncle Norfolk says I'm a whore.
As if he didn't make you one. Are you short of money?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. And no one has even thought about that. No one has even asked me before. I have children, you know that. I need...
She presses her fingers against her mouth to stop it trembling. If you saw my son, well, why do you think I called him Henry? The king would have owned him as his son, just as he has owned Richmond, but my sister forbade it. He does what she says. She means to give him a prince herself, so she doesn't want mine in his nursery.
Reports have been sent to the cardinal. Mary Boleyn's child is a healthy boy with red-gold hair and lively appetites. She has a daughter, older, but in the context that's not so interesting, a daughter. He says, "What age is your son now, Lady Carey?"
3 in March. And my girl Catherine is 5.
Again she touches her lips in consternation.
"I'd forgotten. Your wife died. How could I forget?"
How would you even know, he wonders. But she answers him at once.
Anne knows everything about people who work for the cardinal. She asks questions and writes the answers in a book.
She looks up at him.
And you have children?
Yes. Do you know, no one ever asked me that either. He leans one shoulder against the panelling. And she moves an inch closer. And their faces soften, perhaps from their habitual brave distress, and into the conspiracy of the bereft. "I have a big boy," he says. "He's at Cambridge with a tutor. I have a little girl called Grace. She's pretty, and she has fair hair, though I don't... My wife was not a beauty, and I am, as you see. And I have Anne. Anne wants to learn Greek."
"Goodness," she says. "For a woman, you know..."
"Yes, but she says, why should Thomas More's daughter have the preeminence? She has such good words, and she uses them all."
"You like her best?"
"Her grandmother lives with us, and my wife's sister, but it's not... For Anne, it's not the best arrangement. I could send her into some other household, but then, well, a Greek, and I hardly see her as it is." It feels like the longest speech, unless to Wolsey, that he's made for some time. He says, "Your father should be providing properly for you. I'll ask the cardinal to speak to him."
The cardinal will enjoy that, he thinks. "But I need a new husband to stop them calling me names. Can the cardinal get husbands?"
"The cardinal can do anything. What kind of husband would you like?"
She considers. "One who will take care of my children? One who can stand up to my family? One who doesn't die?" She touches her fingertips together.
"You should ask for someone young and handsome, too. Don't ask, don't get."
"Really? I was brought up in the other tradition."
"Then you had a different upbringing from your sister," he thinks. "In the mask at York Place, do you remember? Were you beauty or kindness?"
"Oh," she smiles, "that must be, what, 7 years ago? I don't remember. I've dressed up so many times."
"Of course, you are still both." That's all I used to care about, dressing up. I remember Anne, though. She was perseverance, he says. Her particular virtue may be tested. Cardinal Campeggio came here with a brief from Rome to obstruct. Obstruct and delay. Do anything but avoid giving judgment. Anne is always writing letters, or writing in her little book. She walks up and down, up and down. When she sees my Lord Father, she holds up a palm to him. Don't dare to speak. And when she sees me, she gives me a little pinch like... Mary demonstrates an airy pinch with the fingers of her left hand. Like that. She strokes the fingers of her right hand along her throat till she reaches the little pulsing dip above her collarbone. There, she says. Sometimes I am bruised. She thinks to disfigure me. I'll talk to the Cardinal, he says. Do. She waits. He needs to go. He has things to do. I no longer want to be a Boleyn, she says, or a Howard. If the King would recognise my boy, it would be different. But as it is, I don't want any more of these masks and parties and dressing up as virtues. They have no virtues. It's all show. If they don't want to know me, I don't want to know them. I'd rather be a beggar. Really? It doesn't have to come to that, Lady Carey. Do you know what I want? I want a husband who upsets them. I want to marry a man who frightens them. There is a sudden light in her blue eyes. An idea has dawned. She rests one delicate finger on the grey velvet she so admires and says softly, "Don't ask. Don't get. Thomas Howard for an uncle. Thomas Boleyn for a father. The King in time for a brother. They'd kill you," he says. He thinks he shouldn't enlarge on the statement. Just let it stand as fact. She laughs, bites her lip. Of course they would. What am I thinking? Anyway, I'm grateful for what you've done already, for an interval of peace this morning. Because when they're shouting about you, they're not shouting about me. One day, she says, Anne will want to talk to you. She'll send for you and you'll be flattered. She'll have a little job for you, or she'll want some advice. So, before that happens, you can have my advice. Turn around and walk the other way. She kisses the tip of her forefinger and touches it to his lips. The Cardinal does not need him that night, so he goes home to Austin Friars. His feeling is to put distance between himself and any Boleyns at all. There are some men, possibly, who would be fascinated by a woman who had been a mistress to two kings, but he is not one of them. He thinks about Sister Anne, why she should take any interest in him. Possibly she has information through what Thomas More calls your evangelical fraternity. And yet this is puzzling. The Boleyns don't seem like a family who think much about their souls. Uncle Norfolk has priests to do that for him. He hates ideas and never reads a book. Brother George is interested in women, hunting, clothes, jewellery and tennis. Sir Thomas Boleyn, the charming diplomat, is interested only in himself. He would like to tell somebody what occurred. There is no one he can tell, so he tells Rafe. "I think you imagined it," Rafe says severely. His pale eyes open wide at the story of the initials inside the heart. But he doesn't even smile. He confines his incredulity to the marriage proposal. She must have meant something else. He shrugs. It's hard to see what. "The Duke of Norfolk would fall on us like a pack of wolves," Rafe says. "He would come round and set fire to our house." He shakes his head. "But the pinching, what remedy?" "Armour, evidently," says Rafe. "It might raise questions." "Nobody's looking at Mary these days," he adds accusingly, "except you." With the arrival of the papal legate in London, The quasi-regal household of Anne Boleyn has broken up. The king does not want the issue confused. Cardinal Campeggio is here to deal with his qualms about his marriage to Catherine, which are quite separate, he will insist, from any feelings he may entertain about Lady Anne. She is packed off to Hever, and her sister goes with her. A rumour floats back to London that Mary is pregnant. Ralph says, "Saving your presence, Master, are you sure you only leaned against the wall?" The dead husband's family says it can't be his child, and the king is denying it too. It's sad to see the alacrity with which people assume the king is lying. How does Anne like it? She'll have time to get over her sulks while she's rusticated. Mary will be pinched black and blue, Ralph says. People all over town tell him the gossip, without knowing quite how interested he is. It makes him sad. It makes him dubious. It makes him wonder about the Boleyns. Everything that passed between himself and Mary he now sees, hears differently. It makes his skin creep. To think that if he had been flattered, susceptible, if he had said yes to her, he might soon have become father to a baby that looked nothing like a Cromwell and very like a Tudor. As a trick, he must admire it. Mary may look like a doll, but she's not stupid. When she ran down the gallery showing her green stockings, she had a sharp eye out for prey. To the Boleyns, other people are for using and discarding. The feelings of others mean nothing, or their reputations, their family name. He smiles at the thought of the Cromwells having a family name, or any reputation to defend. Whatever has happened, nothing comes of it. Perhaps Mary was mistaken, or the talk was simply malice. God knows the family invited. Perhaps there was a child and she lost it. The story peters out with no definite conclusion. There is no baby. It is like one of the Cardinal's strange fairy tales where nature itself is perverted and women are serpents and appear and disappear at will. Queen Catherine had a child that disappeared. In the first year of her marriage to Henry, she miscarried, but the doctors said that she was carrying twins, and the Cardinal himself remembers her at court, with her bodices loosened and a secret smile on her face. She took to her rooms for her confinement. After a time, she emerged tight-laced, with a flat belly and no baby. It must be a Tudor speciality. A little later, he hears that Anne has taken the wardship of her sister's son, Henry Carey. He wonders if she intends to poison him or eat him. New Year, 1529. Stephen Gardiner is in Rome, issuing certain threats to Pope Clement on the king's behalf. The content of the threats has not been divulged to the cardinal. Clement is easily panicked to the best of times, and it is not surprising that with Master Stephen breathing sulphur in his ear, he falls ill. They are saying that he's likely to die, and the Cardinal's agents are around and about in Europe, taking soundings and counting heads, chinking their purses cheerfully. There would be a swift solution to the King's problem if Wolsey were Pope. He grumbles a little about his possible eminence. The Cardinal loves his country, its May garlands, its tender birdsong. In his nightmares he sees squat, spitting Italians, a forest of nooses, a corpse-strewn plain. "I shall want you to come with me, Thomas. You can stand by my side and move quick if any of those cardinals tries to stab me." He pictures his master stuck full of knives, as St. Sebastian is stuck full of arrows. Why does the Pope have to be in Rome? Where is it written? A slow smile spreads over the Cardinal's face. Bring the Holy See home? Why not? He loves a bold plan. I couldn't bring it to London, I suppose. If only I were Archbishop of Canterbury, I could hold my papal court at Lambeth Palace. But old Warham does hang on and on. He always balks me. Your Grace could move to your own see. York is so remote.
I couldn't have the papacy in Winchester. You don't think? Our ancient English capital? And nearer the king?
What an unusual regime this will turn out to be. The king at supper with the Pope, who is also his Lord Chancellor. Will the king have to hand him his napkin and serve him first?
When news comes of Clement's recovery, the cardinal doesn't say a glorious chance lost. He says, Thomas, what shall we do next? We must open the Legatine Court. It can be no longer delayed. He says,
go and find me a man called Anthony Poins.
He stands, arms folded, waiting for further and better particulars.
Try the Isle of Wight, and fetch me Sir William Thomas, whom I believe you will find in Carmarthen. He's elderly, so tell your men to go slowly.
I don't employ anyone slow, he nods. Still, I take the point. Don't kill the witnesses.
The trial of the king's great matter is approaching. The king intends to show that when Queen Catherine came to him, she was not a virgin, having consummated her marriage with his brother Arthur. To that end, he's assembling the gentlemen who attended the royal couple after their wedding at Baynard's Castle, then later at Windsor, where the court moved in November that year, and later at Ludlow, where they were sent to play at Prince and Princess of Wales.
Arthur, Wolsey says, would have been about your age, Thomas, if he had lived.
The attendants, the witnesses, are at least a generation older. And so many years have gone by, 28 to be precise. How good can their memories be? It should never have come to this public and unseemly exposure. Cardinal Campeggio has implored Catherine to bow to the king's will, accept that her marriage is invalid, and retire to a convent. Certainly, she says sweetly, she will become a nun, if the king will become a monk. Meanwhile, she presents reasons why the Legatine Court should not try the issue. It is still sub judice at Rome, for one thing. For another, she is a stranger, she says, in a strange country. She ignores the decades in which she's been intimate with every twist and turn of English policy. The judges, she claims, are biased against her. Certainly she has reason to believe it. Campeggio lays hand on heart and assures her he would give an honest judgment, even if he were in fear of his life. Catherine finds him too intimate with his co-legate. Anyone who has spent much time with Wolsey, she thinks, no longer knows what honesty is. Who is advising Catherine? John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester.
Do you know what I can't endure about that man? The cardinal says. He's all skin and bone. I abhor your skeletal prelate. It makes the rest of us look bad. One looks corporeal.
He is in his corporeal pomp, his finest scarlet, when the king and queen are summoned before the two cardinals at Blackfriars. Everyone had supposed that Catherine would send the proxy, but instead she appears in person. The whole bench of bishops is assembled. The king answers to his name in a full, echoing voice, speaking out of his big, bejewelled chest. He, Cromwell, would have advised a motion of the hand, a murmur, a dip of the head to the court's authority. Most humility, in his view, is pretense, but the pretense can be winning. The hall is packed. He and Rafe are far-off spectators. Afterwards, when the Queen has made her statement, a few men have been seen to cry, they come out into the sunshine. Rafe says, if we had been nearer, we could have seen whether the King could meet her eye.
Yes, that is really all anyone needs to know.
I'm sorry to say it, but I believe Catherine.
Hush, believe nobody.
Something blots out the light. It is Stephen Gardiner, black and scowling, his aspect in no way improved by his trip to Rome.
Master Stephen, he says, how is your journey home? Never pleasant, is it, to come back empty-handed? I've been feeling sorry for you. I suppose you did your best, such as it is.
Gardiner's scowl deepens.
If this court can't give the king what he wants, your master will be finished. Then it is I who will feel sorry for you. Except you won't. Except I won't. Gardiner concedes and moves on. The queen does not return for the sordid parts of the proceedings. Her counsel speaks for her. She has told her confessor how her nights with Arthur left her untouched, and she has given him permission to break the seal of the confessional and make her assertion public. She has spoken before the highest court there is, God's court. Would she lie to the damnation of her soul? Besides, there is another point which everyone has in mind. After Arthur died, she was presented to prospective bridegrooms, to the old king, as it may be, or to the young Prince Henry as fresh meat. They could have brought a doctor who would have looked at her. She would have been frightened, she would have cried, but she would have complied. Perhaps now she wishes it had been so, that they had brought in a strange man with cold hands, but they never asked her to prove what she claimed. Perhaps people were not so shameless in those days. The dispensations for her marriage to Henry were meant to cover either case. She was not a virgin. The Spanish documents are different from the English documents, and that is where we should be now, among the sub-clauses, studying paper and ink, not squabbling in a court of law over a shred of skin and a splash of blood on a linen sheet. If he had been her adviser, he would have kept the queen in court, however much she squealed. Because would the witnesses have spoken to her face as they spoke behind her back? She would be ashamed to face them, gnarled and grizzled, and each equipped with perfect recollection. But he would have had her greet them cordially and declare she would never have recognised them after so much time gone by, and ask if they have grandchildren, whether the summer heat eases their elderly aches and pains. The greater shame would be theirs. Would they not hesitate, would they not falter, under the steady gaze of the Queen's honest eyes? Without Catherine present, the trial becomes a bawdy entertainment. The Earl of Shrewsbury is before the court, a man who fought with the old king at Bosworth. He recalls his own long-ago wedding night when he was, like Prince Arthur, a boy of 15. Never had a woman before, he says, but did his duty to his bride. On Arthur's wedding night, he and the Earl of Oxford had taken the prince to Catherine's chamber. Yes, says the Marquis of Dorset, and I was there too. Catherine lay under the coverlet. The prince got into bed beside her. No one is willing to swear to having climbed in with them, Ralph whispers. But I wonder they haven't found someone. The court must make do with evidence of what was said next morning. The prince, coming out of the bridal chamber, said he was thirsty and asked Sir Anthony Willoughby for a cup of ale. Last night I was in Spain, he said. A little boy's crude joke dragged back into the light. The boy has been, these 30 years, a corpse. How lonely it is to die young, to go down into the dark without any company. Maurice St. John is not there with him, in his vault at Worcester Cathedral. Nor Mr. Cromer, nor Mr. William Woodall, nor any of the men who heard him say, "Masters, it is good pastime to have a wife." When they have listened to all this, and they come out into the air, he feels strangely cold. He puts a hand to his face, touches his cheekbone. Ralph says, "It would be a poor sort of bridegroom who would come out in the morning and say, 'Good day, masters, nothing done.' He was boasting, wasn't he? That was all. They've forgotten what it's like to be 15. Even as the court is sitting, King Francois in Italy is losing a battle. Pope Clement is preparing to sign a new treaty with the Emperor, Queen Catherine's nephew. He doesn't know this when he says, 'This is a bad day's work. If we want Europe to laugh at us, they've every reason now.'" He looks sideways at Ralph, whose particular problem, clearly, is that he cannot imagine anyone, even a hasty 15-year-old, wanting to penetrate Catherine. It would be like copulation with a statue.
Rafe, of course, has not heard the Cardinal on the subject of the Queen's former attractions.
Well, I reserve judgment, which is what the court will do. It's all they can do.
He says,
Rafe, you're so much closer in these matters. I can't remember being 15.
Surely, were you not 15 or so when you fetched up in France?
Yes, I must have been.
Arthur would have been about your age, Thomas, if he had lived.
He remembers a woman in Dover, up against the wall, her small, crushable bones, her young, bleak, pallid face. He feels a small sensation of panic, loss. What if the Cardinal's joke isn't a joke, and the earth is strewn with his children, and he's never done right by them? It is the only honest thing to be done. Look after your children.
Rafe, he says,
do you know I haven't made my will? I said I would, but I never did. I think I should go home and draft it.
Why? Rafe looks amazed. Why now? The Cardinal will want you.
Come home.
He takes Rafe's arm. On his left side, a hand touches his. Fingers without flesh. A ghost walks. Arthur, studious and pale. King Henry, he thinks, you raised him. Now you put him down.
July 1529. Thomas Cromwell of London, gentleman, being whole in body and memory. To his son, Gregory, £666.13.04. And feather beds, bolsters, and the quilt of yellow Turkey satin, the joined bed of Flanders work, and the carved press and the cupboards, the silver and the silver gilt, and 12 silver spoons. And leases of farms to be held for him by the executors till he comes to full age, and another £200 for him in gold at that date. Money to the executors for the upbringing and marriage portions of his daughter Anne and his little daughter Grace. A marriage portion for his niece, Alice Wellyfed. Gowns, jackets and doublets to his nephews. To Mercy, all sorts of household stuff and some silver and anything else the executors think she should have. Bequests to his dead wife's sister Joanne and her husband John Williamson, and a marriage portion to her daughter, also Joanne. Money to his servants. £40 to be divided between 40 poor maidens on their marriage. £20 for mending the roads. £10 towards feeding poor prisoners in the London jails. His body to be buried in the parish where he dies, or at the direction of his executors. The residue of his estate to be spent on masses for his parents. To God, his soul. To Rafe Sadler, his books. When the summer plague comes back, he says to Mercy and Joanne, shall we send the children out? In which direction, Joanne says, not challenging him, just wanting to know. Mercy says, can anyone outrun it? They take comfort from a belief that since the infection killed so many last year, it won't be so violent this year, which he does not think is necessarily true, and he thinks they seem to be endowing this plague with a human, or at least bestial intelligence. The wolf comes down on the sheepfold, but not on the nights when the men with dogs are waiting for him. Unless they think that the plague is more than bestial or human, that it is God behind it, God up to his old tricks. When he hears the bad news from Italy about Clement's new treaty with the emperor, Wolsey bows his head and says, my master is capricious. He doesn't mean the king. On the last day of July, Cardinal Campeggio adjourns the Legatine court. It is, he says, the Roman holidays. News comes that the Duke of Suffolk, the king's great friend, has hammered the table before Wolsey and threatened him to his face. They all know the court will never sit again. They all know the cardinal has failed. That evening with Wolsey, he believes for the first time that the cardinal will come down. If he falls, he thinks, I come down with him.
His reputation is black.
It is as if the cardinal's joke has been incarnated, as if he wades through streams of blood, leaving in his wake a trail of smashed glass and fires, of widows and orphans.
Cromwell, people say, that's a bad man. The cardinal will not talk about what is happening in Italy, or what has happened in the legate's court.
He says, they tell me the sweating sickness is back. What shall I do? Shall I die? I have fought 4 bouts with it. In the year... what year? I think it was 1518. Now, you will laugh, but it was so. When the sweat had finished with me, I looked like Bishop Fisher. My flesh was wasted. God picked me up and rattled my teeth.
Your grace was wasted, he says, trying to raise a smile. I wish you'd had your portrait made then. Bishop Fisher had said in court, just before the Roman holiday set in, that no power, human or divine, could dissolve the marriage of the king and queen. If there's one thing he'd like to teach Fisher, it's not to make grand overstatements. He has an idea of what the law can do, and it's different from what Bishop Fisher thinks. Until now, every day till today, every evening till this, if you told Wolsey a thing was impossible, he'd just laugh. Tonight, he says, when he can be brought to the point, my friend King Francois is beaten and I am beaten too. I don't know what to do. Plague or no plague, I think I may die. I must go home, he says. But will you bless me? He kneels before him. Wolsey raises his hand and then, as if he's forgotten what he's doing, lets it hover in mid-air. He says,
Thomas, I am not ready to meet God.
He looks up, smiling. Perhaps God's not ready to meet you.
I hope that you will be with me when I die.
But that will be at some distant date. He shakes his head.
If you had seen how Suffolk sat on me today, he, Norfolk, Thomas Boleyn, Thomas Lord Darcy, they have been waiting only for this, for my failure with this court. And now I hear they are devising a book of articles. They are drawing up a list of accusations, how I have reduced the nobility and so forth. They are making a book called, what will they call it? 20 Years of Insults. They are brewing some stew pot into which they are pouring the dregs of every slight, as they conceive it, by which they mean every piece of truth I have told them. He takes a great rattling breath and looks at the ceiling which is embossed with the Tudor rose.
There will be no such stew pots in your grace's kitchen, he says.
He gets up. He looks at the cardinal, and all he can see is more work to be done.
Liz Wicks, Mercy says, wouldn't have wanted her girls dragged about the countryside, especially as Anne, to my knowledge, cries if she does not see you.
Anne, he's amazed, Anne cries.
What did you think?
Mercy asks with some asperity.
Do you think your children don't love you?
He lets her make the decision. The girls stay at home. It's the wrong decision. Mercy hangs outside their door, the signs of the sweating sickness. She says, how has this happened? We scour, we scrub the floors. I do not think you will find in the whole of London a cleaner house than ours. We say our prayers. I have never seen a child pray as Anne does. She prays as if she's going into battle. Anne falls ill first. Mercy and Joanne shout at her and shake her to keep her awake, since they say if you sleep, you will die. But the pull of the sickness is stronger than they are, and she falls exhausted against the bolster, struggling for breath, and falls further into black stillness, only her hand moving, the fingers clenching and unclenching. He takes it in his own and tries to still it, but it is like the hand of a soldier itching for a fight. Later, she rouses herself, asks for her mother. She asks for the copybook in which she has written her name. At dawn, the fever breaks. Joanne bursts into tears of relief, and Mercy sends her away to sleep. Anne struggles to sit up. She sees him clearly. She smiles. She says his name. They bring a basin of water strewn with rose petals and wash her face. A finger reaches out, tentative, to push the petals below the water, so each of them becomes a vessel shipping water, a cup, a perfumed grail. But when the sun comes up, her fever rises again. He will not let them begin it again, the pinching and pummeling, the shaking. He gives her into God's hands and asks God to be good to him. He talks to her, but she makes no sign that she hears. He is not himself afraid of contagion. If the cardinal can survive this plague four times, I am sure I am in no danger, and if I die, I have made my will. He sits with her, watching her chest heaving, watching her fight and lose. He is not there when she dies. Grace has already taken sick, and he is seeing her put to bed. So he's out of the room, just. And when they usher him in, her stern little face has relaxed into sweetness. She looks passive, placid. Her hand is already heavy, and heavy beyond his bearing. He comes out of the room. He says, "She was already learning Greek." "Of course," Mercy says. "She was a wonderful child, and your true daughter." She leans against his shoulder and cries. She says, "She was clever and good, and in her way, you know, she was beautiful." His thought had been, she was learning Greek. Perhaps she knows it now. Grace dies in his arms. She dies easily, as naturally as she was born. He eases her back against the damp sheet. A child of impossible perfection. Her fingers uncurling like thin white leaves. "I never knew her," he thinks. "I never knew I had her." It has all seemed impossible to him that some act of his gave her life. Some unthinking thing that he and Liz did on some unmemorable night. They had intended the name to be Henry for a boy, Catherine for a girl, and Liz had said, "That will do honour to your cat as well." But when he had seen her, swaddled, beautiful, finished and perfect, he had said quite another thing, and Liz had agreed. "We cannot earn grace. We do not merit it." He asked the priest if his elder daughter can be buried with her copybook, in which she has written her name, Anne Cromwell. The priest says he's never heard of such a thing. He's too tired and angry to fight. His daughters are now in purgatory, a country of slow fires and ridged ice. Where in the Gospels does it say purgatory? Tyndale says, "Now abideth faith, hope, and love, even these three, but the greatest of these is love." Thomas More thinks it is a wicked mistranslation. He insists on charity. He would chain you up for a mistranslation. He would, for a difference in your Greek, kill you. He wonders again if the dead need translators. Perhaps in a moment, in a simple twist of unbecoming, they know everything they need to know. Tyndale says, "Love never falleth away." October comes in. Wolsey presides, as usual, over the meetings of the King's Council. But in the law courts, as Michaelmas term opens, writs are moved against the Cardinal. He is charged with success. He is charged with the exercise of power. Specifically, he's charged with asserting a foreign jurisdiction in the King's realm, that is to say, with exercising his role as papal legate. What they mean to say is this. He is alter rex. He has always been, more imperious than the king. For that, if it is a crime, he is guilty. So now they swagger into York Place, the Duke of Suffolk, the Duke of Norfolk, the two great peers of the realm. Suffolk, his blonde beard bristling, looks like a pig amongst truffles. A florid man, he remembers, turns my Lord Cardinal sick. Norfolk looks apprehensive, and as he turns over the Cardinal's possessions, it is clear that he expects to find wax figures, perhaps of himself, perhaps with long pins stuck through them. The Cardinal has done his feats by a compact with the devil. That is his fixed opinion. He, Cromwell, sends them away. They come back. They come back with further and higher commissions and better signatures. And they bring with them the Master of the Rolls. They take the Great Seal from my Lord Cardinal. Norfolk glances sideways at him and gives him a fleeting, ferrety grin. He doesn't know why. "Come and see me," the Duke says. "Why, my lord?" Norfolk turns down his mouth. He never explains. "When?" "No hurry," Norfolk says. "Come when you've mended your manners." It is the 19th of October, 1529.
This ends Disc 5.